It's the end of the world as we know it, or at least it seems that way, if you look at what's going on in the culture. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Well, it's the end of the world as we know it, but I feel fine.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of feeling okay, too.
It's good to be back with you this week. It's good to be back recording at all. We did a Camp American show last week. Good to be back making some quasi-live radio.
Now, the question is, Chuck, are we back in the USSR this week? or is that going to happen after the November election?
Well, Georgia's always on my mind, as the song says.
Well, I told you earlier, North Carolina is on my mind.
Yeah, that's right. Not the same Georgia, though, the one Stalin came from.
Ah, yes.
Are we going to be back in the USSR? Well, look, only if Obama gets a third term.
And I'm not sure how he doesn't get a third term, regardless of which party wins with their presumptive nominees.
Well, I don't think it's as bad as all that. This guy has gotten away with things. This is what, if you'll recall, in 08 when Obama and Hillary were running for this office at the same time, We had friends who were involved in the Anybody But Hillary movement. And I can remember being about 6 months into the Barack Obama's first term, and I said, well, you got Anybody But Hillary. How's that working out? And what I meant by that was the fact that Hillary Clinton could not possibly have gotten away with the stuff that Barack Obama has gotten away with. Because the instant that he's questioned, it's immediately dubbed to be, it's because he's black, it's because you're a racist. And that particular card couldn't possibly have been played with Hillary. Now, she could have played, oh, it's because she's a woman. Well, look, that one doesn't play as well. I mean, all you have to do is look at women who have run nations in other places. Golda Meir, Margaret Thatcher, those kinds of things. And that necessarily the best thing that could happen? No, it's not. But it's not also not the worst thing that could happen. It's not the worst thing that a black man would be president. I voted for Alan Keyes once. I voted for Ken Blackwell, despite the rest of the fact that the rest of the Republican Party abandoned him. You and I voted for him.
I worked on that campaign.
That's right.
I've got some fond memories of that, the one of which is not the election night.
Yeah. As I recall, I was at the quote-unquote victory party, which was short-lived.
Yeah, that's usually what happens. That's right.
What's interesting about that, Barry, is that is a very illustrative election.
Yes, it is.
Because what happened there? We've been talking about this conservative versus liberal thing in the Republican Party for a long time. Or when I say, or conservative versus moderate, if you will, moderate is liberal. So, yes, do I take a more black and white view of it? Yeah, and the answer is yes, I do, because it is pretty black and white. Yes, there are nuances within those particular labels, but there's conservative and there's liberal. What happened there was, if you recall, it was a hard fought fight, and Ken Blackwell was always out front in that thing, as I recall, during the nominating process.
Right.
Ken Blackwell had done his homework. He'd done all the front work, and the Republican establishment wanted him gone. And the reason they wanted him gone was precisely because he was actually a conservative and they wanted a moderate.
He did, you know, unforgivable things, Chuck, like remind them that there was a party platform and expecting them to adhere to it.
Well, yeah.
Can't have that in the modern Republican Party.
A problem we never had with John Kasich. John Kasich doesn't care that there's a Republican Party platform, and in fact, I think he's made reference to the fact that we don't follow it.
Right.
And that's not shocking. But going back to the Ken Blackwell illustration,
go ahead.
What happened in that election was that the party elites did exactly what they claim that we do. They became purists on the issue of moderation. In other words, they were moderate purists, and they said, if we can't get the candidate that we want, we're going to take our ball and go home, which they did. And, in fact, some of them actually came out and endorsed Ted Strickland.
Yes, they did.
And, of course, Ted Strickland won that election rather handily, and he did it with the help of Republican Party regulars.
Yes, he did.
And Republican Party leadership. Now, not all of them, but a large enough number that it became noticeable. And this is what they tell us that we do. Well, when they jam yet another moderate or liberal down our throat, us Republicans, and I'll be quite honest, I'm a registered Republican, I don't follow the party line. They say, well, you have to go with the candidate because this is who we have. And then you get the Lucy with the football thing. And yes, we promise you're going to get the candidate you want next time, but this time you have to support our guy because this is who it is. And if we don't have him, we're going to end up with Ted Strickland. Well, they went so far in this case as actually saying we'd rather have Ted Strickland than Ken Blackwell.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did, sadly enough.
And look what it got us. It got a lot of the down ticket one. Honestly, it was a mess.
That was the year that we lost all but one of the statewide offices. And that was because the candidate the Democrats had put up for auditor was an absolute joke of a candidate. And Mary Taylor was the only Republican statewide office holder during that cycle.
Yeah. And if I recall, we rather rapidly, actually, didn't we lose the attorney general because he was corrupt?
Well, actually, we lost the attorney general's race. Well, first of all, you had Mark Dan, who was the original attorney general because they ran Betty Montgomery against him. And Mark Dan won, and then he ended up with a corruption issue and then was replaced by Rich Cordray.
Well, that's what I'm referring to, is the fact that Richard Cordray had to come in for Mark Dan, because there's an old quote that's attributed to Abraham Lincoln about the guy he appointed Secretary of War before Stanton. His name was Simon P. Cameron, a Pennsylvania Republican Party log roller. And even Lincoln said, this is one of those cases, you know, presidents very often don't really pick their cabinets. They're foisted on them. And Lincoln made the statement that Simon P. Cameron was so corrupt that the only thing he wouldn't steal was a hot stove. And as I recall, that was one of the problems we had with Mark Dan. And as I recall, there was one incident early on when he was confronted by reporters about something, and his response was to make an obscene gesture with his middle finger to the press. This shows you the caliber of individual that got elected. And of course, Richard Cordray was thrown out as quickly as he could be. Ted Strickland was thrown out as quickly as he could be. And most of the other statewide offices were thrown out as quickly as they could be. Thank you, Republican Party. Unfortunately, they were replaced with people that weren't necessarily, I mean, that's how we got John Kasich. We got John Kasich because people were sick of the incompetence of Ted Strickland, essentially.
That's true. That was good history, because history seems to want to repeat itself here. We have a situation now where the National Republican Party is basically doing quite the same thing. As everybody's aware, you know, by now, there's only one man left standing in the Republican nominating process, and that is Donald Trump. Surprise, surprise. And so now the party regulars are, some of them are swallowing hard, like Rince Priebus, who is the head of the RNC, and saying, yes, we're going to get behind our nominee. But there are many of the other ones who, just like that example of the Blackwell issue in 2006, are saying, we don't like what he stands for, and that's not what we stand for. So therefore, we'll either set out or we'll go vote for Hillary Clinton. And we've talked about on this program in the past about some of the, even the supposed delegates to the Republican National Convention openly discussing for voting for Hillary Clinton if Donald Trump is the nominee. And guess what? It's looking like fairly clearly, Chuck, and I think he's probably within a couple of more in-the-bag elections in California and others to where he actually will come in to the convention with more than the 1,237 necessary delegate votes in order to secure the nomination.
That's getting pretty close to a lead pipe cinch at this point.
Pretty much about done. Now, I think it's interesting because Trump is actually starting to do some things that actually make sense now. We've talked about how nonsensical his campaign has been in the past. Little hands and little Marco and all this other good stuff, and basic throwing temper tantrums and threatening to make Mexico pay for a wall, which I'd love to see happen, but I don't believe in a minute that's going to happen.
Can we stop just for a second? Keep that train of thought going. But, you know, I've talked to a couple people about this, the whole Mexico wall thing.
Right.
Now, if you recall, Donald Trump actually came up with something that could force them to do it.
Okay.
And that was stopping, what do they call it, when Mexicans send money home by wire? It's basically money transfers back to Mexico. And he said, he said, basically, here's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to stop allowing money to go to transfer from here back to Mexican banks.
Ah.
And the first thing that happened was Mexican President Vicente Fox had a meltdown. And
mm-hmm, of course.
Because he knows that if that happens, the Mexican economy will collapse.
The other part of that is, Chuck, it will be much more difficult to hide and launder the cartel drug money that goes through those Mexican banks if you don't have that influx of money that's coming from across the border.
Exactly.
So, okay, so Donald may have come up with a couple of ideas, but the latest thing that he's done, and this was just today, Chuck, as we record this on Wednesday night, the 18th, after a long day at the State House for me, is that Trump today unveiled a list of judges he would consider nominating to fill Antonin Scalia's seat on the Supreme Court. Now, this is supposedly a way to reach out to conservatives and to reassure them or appeal to them that he's not going to pick his sister, who's a federal court judge and who is like a fan of partial birth abortions, even though they're illegal in the country. She thinks that they're A-OK. And he wanted to help reassure conservatives that I'm not that totally off my rocker, that I know better than to pick these wrong people. I want to read you the list of the 11 names that he put out on this list. Now, again, these are just ones he would consider nominating. This isn't a lockdown for Trump if he wins the nomination and he actually does get to pick the next Supreme Court justice, you know, if the Republican Senate doesn't cave first and give it to Obama. And he's not bound by this, but this is like the front piece that you put out there in order to get people drawn in. It's like a carnival barker. Let me give you something exciting to get you to go inside and spend your money and go inside, and then once you get inside, you realize it's all smoke and mirrors. The list is, and I'm going to read this list of names to you, Chuck, and let me know if you know any of these, okay? Stephen Colleton of Iowa, Allison Eade of Colorado, Raymond Grunder of Missouri, Thomas Hardiman of Pennsylvania, Raymond Kethledge of Michigan, Joan Larson of Michigan, Thomas Lee of Utah, who actually happens to be the brother of Utah Senator Mike Lee.
Mike Lee, yeah.
David Strass of Minnesota, Diane Sykes of Wisconsin, Don Willett of Texas, and the last name, and I saved this one for last, Chuck, because I know you know this name, William Pryor of Alabama.
Oh, my gosh. Bill Pryor. Well,
yes, you tell.
I would not be a supporter of the nomination of Bill Pryor as the Supreme Court Justice. Bill Pryor is who helped railroad for the federal government Judge Roy Moore the first time he was removed from office in Alabama as a complete spit in the face of the Alabama electorate. He was removed from office for essentially attempting to assert the right of the state as guaranteed under the 10th Amendment.
Right.
And Bill Pryor, for his duplicity, was rewarded with a federal court appointment by George W. Bush. So, yeah, I recognized a couple of those other names passingly.
Okay.
As I recall, being involved in decisions that were questionable.
Okay, yeah. Most of the names that I was unfamiliar with, I'm assuming that these are mainly either state or federal court judges of one stripe or the other. I'm not sure if the two from Michigan, Larson and Kethledge, are actually on the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and I'll have to check that at another point in time. But for purposes of our discussion, I just wanted to throw that out there because I didn't know if you'd seen this or not already today.
I had not.
But when I saw Bill Pryor's name on there, I thought, well, if this is supposedly representative of the, as he says, he, quote, representative of the kind of constitutional principles I value, well, Trump did nothing to reassure me or to convince me to vote for him. As a matter of fact, I'm now a little bit more concerned that, and as he said in his statement, he said that he planned to use this as a guide to nominate the next Supreme Court justice. In other words, these names are not probably the people I'm picking, but I'm going to use it kind of as a guide.
Yeah, this is the judicial philosophy that I'm looking for.
So basically what he's trying to do now is trying to woo the conservative base of the Republican Party. He's already wooed from early on the Tea Party base of the party by talking tough against government and then flip-flopping on just about everything he's talked to him about already once he got toward winning the nomination. Now he's reaching out to the conservative base who would have supported the Ted Cruz's or the Carly Fiorina's or the Marco Rubio's of the world. And yes, I know I'm stretching it by saying conservative with Marco Rubio. But, you know, I have a feeling that this is the same kind of MO that Trump has shown before, where I'm going to talk a real good game and coax you in with these high-sounding promises, but then when we get closer to actually having to make a decision or when push comes to shove, that's not going to be anywhere near what I've actually believed. And I think that if people fall for this, and of course, you know, it's flashed out there on all of the various news sites. And so CNN, and I'm over on CNN site, they have a law professor at American University saying that this list is, quote, red meat to conservatives. These are 11 well-regarded conservative judges with consistent credentials, folks who I think could reasonably be expected to try and follow in Justice Scalia's footsteps, unquote. So, spins out there already. He's bringing the second coming of Antonin Scalia as president.
Which
I'm not going to buy this as legitimate of Trump's conservative credentials when it comes to the potential of nominating a Supreme Court justice.
Right. Look, again, this kind of stuff, the convention hasn't happened yet, and Trump does not yet have to start running to the left. In fact, he has been successful. He has openly stated things, and it didn't seem to cost him anything, about continuing funding for Planned Parenthood and any number of things that would normally have really jittered, especially Christian conservatives and Christian constitutionalists. He has said things, and it's just basically, don't confuse me with facts. I mean, that's the way the campaign has been run. All what's gone on here, this has been a big emotional response, and it hasn't been well thought through. And we've talked about this before. The real problem here is that the Republican Party has been so unresponsive to the conservative wing of the party, mm-hmm. that anyone that comes in and gives those same elites and Republican leadership a hot foot is a hero. And the only place that seems to be kind of schizophrenic on this, believe it or not, is Ohio.
Yeah, I believe it.
Think about it. We heard about Kasich's one win, his one state win, right? And where was it?
Right. It was Ohio.
Yeah, and what percentage of the vote did he get?
He got 48% of the vote that was cast.
Was it 48? I thought it was 46. Nonetheless.
Oh, okay, it was 48.
It's less than 50%. Of Republicans. And in fact, in a couple of state primaries, Kasich actually got beat by people who weren't in the race anymore.
That was in Arizona when Marco Rubio came in third to John Kasich's fourth, although Rubio had withdrawn from the race already and there were only three people running in Arizona.
That's right.
The other interesting thing about all that, Chuck, especially the Ohio information, is that there have been analyses done now and broken down, and it is obvious that during that Ohio primary that John Kasich won by 48% of the vote, there was a massive shift of people pulling Republican ballots who had either pulled independent ballots before and been non-affiliated, or had pulled Democrat ballots before. There was quite a bit of crossover to the tune of, I believe, over 200,000 Democrats had crossed over to vote Republican, and over 700,000 independents had pulled a Republican ballot, many for the first time. And I think I talked about this a little bit on a previous program, that even like some at Delaware County, and I know that for sure because I knew some people who were running up there, you know, they looked at their numbers too, and what they found out was much the same. That in Delaware County, which has 28,000 registered Republicans in the county, there were 51,000 Republican ballots cast in that primary, for this primary. So for John Kasich to say he won Ohio, you know, convincingly, and that was bona fides for him being president or for even being on somebody's ticket, you know, when you start parsing those numbers down, it very well could be that much of Kasich's support, or maybe even Trump's support in Ohio, we're coming from people who might very well go back across the aisle in the general election.
Exactly. Yep, exactly. That's again, this is the issue with open primaries.
That's a major issue with open primaries.
Well, that's right. And the same thing happened in New Hampshire, as I recall. A lot of people crossed over to vote for Trump who won't necessarily vote for Trump in the fall. And I can remember, actually, in 2008, if you'll recall, Rush Limbaugh's Operation Chaos. Do you remember that whole mess where he said you could possibly go register as a Democrat and go over and vote for somebody other than Hillary? Which some people did.
And you know, Chuck, one of the things that you have to think about when we're talking about this whole issue of crossover votes and Operation Chaos type things, and I'm not even sure we really even talked about that much, but this whole thing started back with Rush Limbaugh a number of years ago, back during the 2008 election cycle, when Hillary was running for president on the Democratic ticket the first time in the primary.
The whole thing behind that is, gee, thanks, Rush. The fact is that the Democratic candidate, whoever they were, was probably going to end up being the president in that election. There was a huge backlash against George W. Bush, some cases for the right reasons, in some cases for the wrong reasons. But nonetheless, it was pretty much a lead pipe cinch. And remember, we talked about the whole Republican repudiation in Ohio with the Ken Blackwell thing and Ted Strickland coming in and doing a clean swipe on the offices, which lasted exactly one term on the major state offices. And that was the trend at the time. And then once people replaced a number of these people that they saw as part of the problem with these new people, it turned out that the new people were a worse part of the problem than the people that preceded them. So they broomed them out as well. But that being said, my brother and I have discussed this on numerous occasions. Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton could not possibly have gotten the things done that Barack Obama did. And we also mentioned that earlier in the show. But that's something that has to be talked about, because the fact is, Barack Obama, he was far more charismatic than Hillary is. Hillary has no charisma whatsoever and has that race card thing that he can play. And he is, as we have seen in the last 8 years, he is not remiss about playing it at all. Or in some cases, he doesn't play it, but he lets his surrogates play it for him. So what I'm saying is the agenda would not have advanced anywhere near as quickly under Hillary as it has under Barack Obama. So what did we get from all this political maneuver, you know, being way too smart for our own good political maneuvering? We've proved that we were way too, when I say we, I was not part of this. Some people proved they were way too smart for their own good.
And we have another example of that right now, or numerous examples of that right now during the 2016 election race. And one of the key ones here, and maybe a lot of people haven't heard about this or don't know about it, but that as the field was narrowing and narrowing and narrowing to the point where we finally got down to Donald Trump being the presumptive and all but assured Republican nominee for the 2016 presidential election, there were efforts to recruit certain candidate to run as an independent, even though they were currently running in the Republican Party primary. And no, Chuck, I'm not talking about Ted Cruz. This wasn't the conservative evangelicals' pipe dream of, okay, you know, if our guy can't win in the party, we'll take him outside and run him. This was actually some of the establishment guys, one in particular whose name is extremely familiar to pretty much everybody, making this effort to try to create a third party run. Or an independent, they call it an independent run, Chuck, because right. They wouldn't align with another party, because that would be, you know, verboten as a Republican. But it's not verboten as a Republican just to go ahead and run independent.
Well, that's an important nuance, I think. If you think about it, Barry, we're not running as a third party, we're running as an independent.
Right, which basically amounts to the same thing.
Exactly. It's putting your eggs from one basket into another one and calling it different, and it's not different. So, sorry to interrupt, but I think that's an important nuance that isn't one. A rose by any other name will smell as sweet, and a skunk by any other name will smell just as bad.
Well, and the point is that the problem with that whole scenario, and as soon as I tell you who was the person they wanted to have run and why it basically couldn't have happened, it's kind of funny. Drew the major plotter in this escapade was none other than former Republican presidential candidate nominee in 2012, Mitt Romney. As you remember, Romney was making a bunch of noises about jumping into the Republican primary himself and blah, 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 and et cetera, after his miserably failed run against Barack Obama in 2012. And so what happened was, right after the field cleared, when everybody else dropped out and left Donald Trump as the last man standing on the political survivor game, Romney reached out to John Kasich, our own Ohio governor, and urged him to run as an independent and saying that he would do anything he needed to help. In other words, Romney was basically saying, I'll turn my machine and my money behind you to get you to run against Donald Trump as a third choice in the general election. Supposedly, the governor, according to advisors to John Kasich, demurred. In other words, that's a polite way of saying that told Mitt Romney, you're insane.
Yeah, well, I told him to take a long walk on a short pier with lead weights in his pockets. Yeah, essentially, and it shows the insanity of Romney.
Romney had also reached out to Ben Sasse, who was the senator from Nebraska, I believe.
Yeah.
Who's also been very much anti-Trump, but at the same time, quote-unquote, ruling out the possibility that he will mount his own independent campaign. Well, of course he won't. He's going to talk these other people into running like Don Quixote, and that way he doesn't end up himself setting outside the Republican mainstream. You know, he's still a good, loyal Republican. But the problem that Mitt Romney has, and I think it was a similar problem that he had in 2012, is he doesn't understand the basic rules that his party helped to put in place that made it impossible for John Kasich to say yes.
Oh, Barry, this is such a... Okay, there's a phrase, and it's that you're being hoisted by your own petard.
Exactly, exactly.
Here we are. The GOP establishment is being hoisted by its own petard here.
Yes, and Mitt Romney, as the establishment flag carrier, was hoisted higher than anybody else on this one, because the problem with asking John Kasich to mount an independent run for president, now again, maybe federal law might allow this on a general basis, but Ohio law certainly will not, because in Ohio we have what's called the sore loser law. And a sore loser law says that if you run in a party primary for an office, you are barred from then turning around and running as an independent after the primary is over with in the general election. Because in order to run in the general election as a non-party candidate, you have to file your petitions and your paperwork the day before the party primary. So Ohio, the party primary was Tuesday, March 15th. All non-major party candidates, non-Republicans and non-Democrats who were running as independents, had to file their paperwork and their signatures to get on the general ballot on March the 14th. And, you know, in the U.S. Senate race, we have one. Again, you know, so you got Rob Portman, who won his Republican primary against conservative Don Eckert, but lost almost 20% of the vote to Eckert, which is telling.
That's very telling, because nobody knows who Don Eckert is except you and me.
Except for a small handful of us inside who've known him for years. And then on the Democrat side, you know, former Ohio Governor Ted Strickland beat back his challenge from Cincinnati City Councilman P.G. Sittenfeld. But now they're not running head to head anymore, because on the 14th of March, a third candidate filed paperwork and petitions to run independently against both of them on the general election ballot. An attorney by the name of Tom Connors from the Akron area, who I just found out through some channels, his petitions were validated and certified. He had enough signatures. So you're going to have another option on the U.S. Senate race with Mr. Connors. If you don't like Rob Portman and you don't really want to vote for Ted Strickland, either one, sir, he's very conservative and he's thoughtful and he's actually got a plan and a program. So there's an option there. But you move over to John Kasich. John Kasich ran in the Republican Party primary in Ohio for president. He was on the ballot. Matter of fact, he won. We just talked about that.
That's right.
Which means by Ohio sore loser law, he is barred from then turning around and mounting an independent campaign for the same office in Ohio. So he might be able to do it nationally, but he couldn't appear on the Ohio ballot. And wow, Chuck, let me think about this. No Republican, and I'm going to still count him as a Republican, even though he'd be running on an independent ticket, presumptively. No Republican has ever won the White House without winning Ohio, right? That's how the story goes. So how can you win Ohio if you're not recognized as running for the seat in Ohio because of our sore loser laws? Mitt Romney's folks don't do very good background research.
No.
Well, and that was obvious during the 2012 race when he made a bunch of gaffes.
Oh, yeah.
But the point is that this is absolutely ridiculous. But it does highlight something, Chuck. It highlights that there is probably some opportunity during this 2016 cycle for non-major party candidates to pick up support. Now, whether that support comes from establishment Republicans who just can't stand Donald Trump and just in feel it's completely disloyal to vote for Hillary Clinton, and so many of them don't now. Let's make sure that's clear.
Yeah.
Or it's coming from disaffected independents who maybe came across and voted for, whether it was a John Kasich or whether it was a Mitt Romney or not Mitt Romney, but Donald Trump, or they came across and voted for a Marco Rubio or something in one of these primaries because they weren't big on socialism heavy and socialism heavier, which is Bernie and Hillary. But they really are not going to, now that Donald Trump has flip-flopped on a lot of the issues that he's running on, including one that we just talked about earlier because we had to do the break in our recording here, so we came back a couple of days later to finish this. Chuck, within 24 hours after Donald Trump made the announcement and gave that list out of the 11 potential picks for the Supreme Court, within 24 hours he was already backtracking on it and turning around and saying, I may be looking at somebody completely different. It came out in the media, so it's like, okay, so he can't even hold it for 24 hours before he has to spin it the other direction. I'm just wondering, Donald Trump may end up losing some of his core base support if he keeps doing this, and where are they going to go? Well, there's a couple of places they can go because there are other parties that will be appearing on the ballot in November. One of them, the main one that most people recognize, is the Libertarian Party of the United States. And the Libertarian Party just picked their nominee and their running mate for the office of president. And they picked the former New Mexico governor, Gary Johnson, as their standard bearer. And then it was just announced this week that the former Republican governor, and now Gary Johnson ran as a Republican in New Mexico, but he's actually a filed Libertarian now, so there's no issue about sore losers on this. He picked Bill Weld, the former Republican governor of Massachusetts, as his running mate. So you got the Johnson-Weld ticket coming for the Libertarians. Now, back in 2012, Johnson also ran for president under the Libertarian ticket, where he pulled about 1% of the vote in the general election. Okay, but he finished third behind the Republican and the Democrat and the Republican. Now, let me make sure I don't put that in the wrong order, because Mitt Romney certainly did not win in 2012. But I'm kind of wondering if maybe a guy like Gary Johnson is going to pull maybe quite a bit more support this time around from Libertarians and Independents and maybe more moderate Democrats, because I don't think he's certainly going to pick up any support from the evangelical conservatives of the world, given the fact that Gary Johnson is a classical Libertarian, which means that he's big against big government expansion and wants smaller government, but he wants government so small that we don't protect people against social vices like drug use and prostitution and abortion. So, you know, we have that we've got to work with, too.
Yeah, he's what I would call an extreme Libertarian. And the reason he may have some success, he and William Weld, I really don't get as a choice, I'll be quite honest. Huh?
Well, it's balance, Chuck. It's balance. You know, you're going to the Northeast, you're picking a former governor. So basically they can say they're the only ticket that's going to have two former governors. And they've got another option too, Chuck. And I mean, it isn't quite about that pick so far, but their other option is that the Libertarian Party is the only third party or non-major party that actually will be on the ballot in all 50 states.
Yeah, and that's something, you know, full disclosure, you and I were both in leadership in the Ohio Constitution Party at one point, and I have an idea come up a little later in our discussion on this issue. Sure. So, full disclosure, we are former members of leadership of that party, and we were thrown out.
Right, exactly.
Also, by way of, we were thrown out for actually fighting in national committee meetings over the fact that the state should actually be held to the primary or to the platform.
Yes.
Basically, unlike the other major parties like Ohio, who doesn't adhere to the national platform of the Republicans.
Right, right. The Ohio Republican Party, who said that, you know, the platform, the party platform, no, we don't require our candidates to adhere to that, because that would force us to actually, you know, hold to something. at least that's what the state party chairman said in an interview. It's like, yeah, we don't do that because we don't want to be held to it.
Yeah, but this is an interesting ticket in that if you look at the trends in politics over the mm-hmm. last, since 2012, the younger crowd, the 20 somethings, the millennials, are a lot more potently libertarian than they have been. Now, I had someone say, aren't college students becoming more conservative? I said, no, they're not. They're becoming more libertarian.
Yes, they are. That's
and I
right.
said, there is a quantum difference between those two things. Classical conservatism, at least as it's been defined, I don't want to get into the whole, we can get into the philosophy of classical liberalism, blah, blah, blah. But what we call conservatism essentially is a small government, but it's not, it's essentially protect things like the unborn. Some conservatives would use the power of the federal government for things that it's really not designed for and that kind of thing. That's why I don't call myself a conservative.
But, right, because a lot of them are now big government conservatives. And you know they're big government conservatives, Chuck, when they use adjectives to describe their conservatism. They're compassionate conservatives. They're concerned conservatives. They're conservative conservatives.
Yes, exactly.
all of that stuff actually means we're okay with expanding government to get what we want.
And libertarians are really, they aren't quite anarchists, but they're getting close, because what they basically want people to be able to do is whatever their heart desires. Gary Johnson has for a long time been not just pro-medical marijuana, which I don't have a problem with. He's just pro-marijuana, period. If you want to get high, go ahead.
You know, there's my reason why I could never be a libertarian, Chuck, and you just announced it there. They want to have people get whatever their heart desires, but we as Christians know that Scripture says that the heart is deceitful and desperately wicked above all things. Who can know it? Out of Jeremiah. So, you know, that truth sets there that outside of Christ, we are, you know, our hearts are turned to evil. And that, if you look at the Libertarian Party, and I'm not saying libertarians are not Christian, so
right,
please don't
right,
start
right.
screaming at us, ladies and gentlemen, because we know a number of libertarians who are Christians. And they have fights within their own party over this whole issue as well, just like Chuck and I had fights in the Constitution Party
exactly.
when we were in it. But the point is that, you know, that means that if you're a consistent libertarian, you are in favor of legalizing drugs, not just medical marijuana, but legalizing drugs, stopping the war on drugs is what they call it. So in other words, if anybody wants to take any kind of mind or mood altering drug, regardless of what it is, it should be okay. They're in favor of legalizing the exchange of money for intimacy, i.e. what we call prostitution, which is illegal. They're also for abortion on demand at any point.
Well, basically,
if they're consistent libertarians.
Exactly. They're sort of like, you know, in our particular position is the federal government shouldn't be involved in this at all. Really. It should be left back up to the states, and the states then should outlaw abortion like they did up until 1973 for the most part. I think there were like three states that allowed there was really one that allowed abortion on demand for any reason. I think that was New York.
Mm-hmm.
The other ones had some different nuances, but I think Colorado and California were the other two. But that being said, libertarians are basically like, not only should the federal government not be involved in any aspect of it, but neither should the state governments. In other words, the state government should not operate in their capacity to protect the citizens who are basically considered second-class citizens by virtue of where they currently reside. And they currently reside inside their mother's body.
Mm-hmm.
And libertarians, I don't want to paint with a broad brush, because not all libertarians see that way. And they will give you a libertarian argument about why that particular position is wrong. And I will say, for instance, I am a big fan of Dr. Thomas Woods, Tom Woods. And Tom Woods would give you a pro-life libertarian argument. And it would be a very strong pro-life libertarian argument.
Right.
There are that is that faction. He is also a Latin Mass Catholic and therefore a practicing Christian.
Right.
He would argue strongly that libertarianism and Christianity are highly compatible. And his form of libertarianism, I would say that's true, because it's mostly about protecting the rights of the individual, and especially as it has to do with free markets, and has to do with the rights of people to do essentially, you know, do business and do what they would with their families. You're going to run into trouble with things like the control of who can get married and that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And the reason why we're talking about this in depth about the libertarians, Chuck, is because this ticket of Johnson and Weld actually can create some issues around the November election, because, again, they only won one. Gary Johnson only took 1% of the national vote in 2012. However, in the new scenario, and this is coming from the Washington Times, who just put this out on Wednesday, and it's with the headline, "Did the Libertarian Party just stumble upon a viable stop Trump ticket?" And they're looking at some electoral math on this issue, right. and I guess Fox News or someone just put out a poll. Yeah, Fox News released a poll suggesting that in a three-way matchup with Trump and Clinton, that the Libertarian Gary Johnson would most likely pull 10% of the national vote. Now, again, maybe that's once people get to know it a little bit more, that number will drop, but it's certainly much more than 1% of the national vote. And it creates some interesting speculation. You know, part of the reason why he might have picked Bill Weld. Bill Weld was a popular governor in Massachusetts. And if you look at the map.
Yeah.
And if you look at the electoral map, and this is where the Electoral College comes into play. There was a projection that the Washington Post did looking at how Barack Obama won in 2012 and just basically kind of duplicating that. With this whole situation of, okay, let's say that Hillary does just what Barack Obama does, then the electoral map is going to show Hillary with 332 votes and Trump with 206. But he said, now let's enter the realm of speculation. If the Johnson-Weld ticket capture their home states, which is New Mexico and Massachusetts, with basically a total of 16 electoral votes between the two of them. And honestly, yes, that's possible. It may not be probable, but it is possible that they could end up winning at home, just like John Kasich won in Ohio. And if Trump manages to capture, say, Florida and Pennsylvania or Ohio, so in other words, if he goes down and wins Florida, which he's likely to do, and can capture either Pennsylvania or Ohio and keep the other states that Mitt Romney had won in 2012, which is not going to be very hard for Donald Trump. I'm going to tell you that right now. That will not be a hard thing for him to hold on to. That what happens with that scenario is that nobody wins, Chuck. It goes to the House of Representatives, because the final vote count between Clinton and Trump would be Clinton would have 267 of the 272 electoral votes needed to win the presidency. Trump would have 255, and it would go to the House of Representatives. Which would make for interesting civics lessons for everybody, When was the last time that a presidential election had to go to the House of Representatives to be determined?
1876.
Exactly, 1876. Folks, we may be looking at something that hasn't occurred in 140 years. And so, honestly,
and what's the name
I'm kind of wishing the libertarians will win their home states of Mexico and Massachusetts.
Now, let me ask you a question: What is that election generally referred to as?
Oh gosh,
the stolen election.
The stolen election. That's right. Oh yes.
Samuel J. Tilden should have been president, not Benjamin Harrison.
Right. So basically, it's important, because if Gary Johnson and Bill Weld actually play spoiler, and again, this is a viable option, especially if Bernie Sanders supporters stay home.
You've stumbled upon something. I'm going to make a couple of comments first on this, the math on this article.
Right. The math is like a very hypothetical.
Yes. It's a foregone conclusion to the Washington Post and Big Shock that Hillary's going to win no matter what.
Exactly.
I think that's an absurdity.
I think it's very questionable to start going there and also to assume that she's basically going to win every state that Barack Obama won, because I think she's going to have some significant problems in the far northeast, the far west.
Yeah.
Because states like Minnesota, I think she's going to have an awful hard time in those states. And then if Trump actually wins an Ohio or a Florida or a Pennsylvania, which he very well could, you could be saying hello to President Donald right. Trump, with the exception of the fact that if Johnson and Weld actually show as well as people might think they would now, you might be saying hello to whomever Paul Ryan in the House of Representatives decides to vote for.
That's right.
And that is where the whole issue of who Donald Trump picks as a running mate is going to start coming in.
That's right.
Because, you know, they're looking at this math, too. I think we're going to be saying hello, possibly, and I'm just speculating, probably to a Trump-Ryan ticket if he thinks it's going to get him in.
It could happen. Now, but the two things I wanted to point out, A, the Clintons are essentially very good, very, very good at using third-party candidates to steer the Electoral College their way. And by that I mean 1992. Who was the third party guy in 1992?
Ross Perot.
Ross Perot.
The giant sucking sound.
The giant sucking sound. And what was Ross, and who really in essence was Ross Perot? He was a closet Clintonian.
He was the Clinton secret weapon.
Yes, exactly. Now, does that mean actually that he was necessarily, picked directly by Bill and Hillary? No, but don't kid yourself.
Well, of course it does. Now, Chuck, I'm of the mindset now that was an entirely scripted campaign with Perot being in the place of the mummery.
Okay, and that whole thing where he pulled out because George Bush was going to ruin his daughter's wedding and then he went back into the race.
Mm-hmm.
The real reason he pulled out was because the Clintons said, you're drawing too much from us.
Exactly. They had to stop his momentum.
So he did the dutiful thing. He made up a story about George W. Bush. I mean, of all the silliness, this, you know, he's a former director of the CIA. Therefore, he's going to screw up my daughter's wedding. George Bush couldn't care.
His machinations are going to ruin my daughter's wedding.
George Bush couldn't care less about Ross Perot's daughter's wedding. Okay, now, having said that, there's another factor that comes into play here, and that's what I mentioned earlier, that millennials are trending libertarian. And Gary Johnson is the kind of person that the thinking college students and that kind of thing would go to. They like Bernie's free stuff, but they also like the fact that Gary Johnson is libertarian and wants to let them do what they want to do. Yeah, he's not offering as much free stuff. And a lot of college millennials who would reluctantly perhaps vote for Clinton because they don't like Trump could be very easily drawn off to vote for a Johnson-Weld ticket.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with the libertarian leaning. So just assuming that it's going to be two states is also
wishful thinking by the Washington Post.
That's
right, because they could win four or five states.
They very easily.
Especially if the Bernie supporters commit themselves to wrecking Hillary Clinton.
I could see easily, I mean, after all, I could see easily Massachusetts, Vermont, a couple other heavy libertarian-leaning states going to a Johnson-Weld ticket.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can even see in some places where the Republican establishment, hating Trump, might work machinations behind the scenes in order to open the door for Johnson's message to get out even further in their states.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, there's all kinds of things that can be played behind the scenes on this and create electoral chaos, which is another reason why we have the Electoral College, Chuck.
Well, Barry,
and why we should get back to assigning those electoral votes by congressional district like Maine and Nebraska still do, and not by winner take all like Ohio does.
And honestly, Barry, that was the original plan. I talk about that in a lecture that I give on the Electoral College. Folks, if you've got a group out there that wants to really understand how the Electoral College is supposed to work, I have a one-hour lecture that I do on that subject. I think you would find it very interesting. I've given it to a couple of Tea Party groups, and they always come away going, I had no idea this is the way this was supposed to work. And, you know, the Electoral College always takes it on the chin around presidential election time because people don't understand it and don't understand what it's for and don't understand the fact that it was designed to make certain that the big states didn't overwhelm the little states and that the big cities didn't overwhelm the country. That's why they do it by a system called proportional representation, which basically makes it no longer makes, if we would adopt that in Ohio, it would basically be no longer the case that Cleveland, Columbus, Cincinnati, Youngstown, and Toledo would choose the presidential candidate for the state.
In Ohio, yeah.
In fact, what would happen was the state would be split up and several electoral votes would go here and several would go there. So it wouldn't be winner take all. Winner take all is an abomination. And we showed that with in Ohio this year, the machinations that were done with Ohio's political primary to make sure that John Kasich, with 48% of the vote, got all of the delegates because he was the top vote getter. That shows what's wrong with winner take all. Who's protected? The elite were protected. Who was not protected? All the 52% who did not vote for John Kasich.
That's right.
And that's why winner take all again is abomination and criminally so in my opinion. So the bottom line is that this Gary Johnson thing could really wreak havoc. Now, don't take my thing as an endorsement because I wouldn't vote for Gary Johnson for dog catcher.
Oh, no. And honestly, you know, I'm looking, and that's one of the other things we were going to talk about was there's also another party who probably won't appear on the Ohio ballot, sadly, but who has put forward their nominee for president of the United States, and that is the Constitution Party. That's the reason why, Chuck, you had a disclaimer up front about us. We used to be involved in the Constitution Party, and actually we know the presidential nominee. He is a personal injury and bankruptcy attorney from Memphis, Tennessee, by the name of Daryl Castle. And Daryl Castle is running for president on the Constitution Party ticket in 2016. Now, the big problem with the CP is that ballot access issues, and they've missed many deadlines for getting onto the ballot in a number of states. And that makes it that much more difficult for them to actually mount what would be considered an effective campaign. Now, the Constitution Party's vice presidential nominee is a gentleman by the name of Scott Bradley, who's an independent business owner from northern Utah. And so the Castle-Bradley ticket is another option for people who don't like either the Trump or the Clinton or the Johnson ticket. But sadly, in one sense, then that's not going to be the case unless you write somebody like a Daryl Castle in Ohio. Because as far as I know, Chuck, the Constitution Party, and the only way they can get on the ballot in Ohio now is with legal action. And given the Ohio Secretary of State's office's position on a lot of these things, I'm not seeing them getting it.
Not happening. And in fact, if you recall, right after we were thrown out, ballot access was given by Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner to a number of third parties, the Green Party, the Constitution Party, the Libertarian Party, the Natural Law Party. And if I seem to recall a kind of a almost a cartoonish appearance in a gubernatorial debate with a Natural Law Party candidate.
Right. Yeah, that was when they had like the other debate during the 2000.
Debate.
I think that was the 2004 election, wasn't it, or 2008?
It was
2004.
Oh, could it have been? No, because Jen Bruner didn't become. Was that 04?
She didn't make, she didn't become Secretary of State till 06, so it had to be the 08
election. Yeah. That being said, that was a very cynical political move in order to draw votes away from John McCain. to allow the Constitution Party. They weren't too worried about the Green Party. They were more worried about the CP drawing votes away from John McCain. And I think the candidate was Chuck Baldwin.
Yes, he was. That's right.
And he and the Constitution Party that year did get more votes nationally than they'd ever had before by a wide margin.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is that we always had good success. When we ran Mike Perutka in 2004, we had ballot access. And it doesn't sound like much. We got Mike Perutka 12,000 votes. Well, guess what? The only other state that beat us was California.
Yep.
And they only doubled us.
And it's come to light now that I think we talked about this on a previous program, that the situation was that the Constitution Party affiliate in California was known as the American Independent Party.
Right.
And so when people go to register to vote in California, there's this huge list of parties because California basically like allows ballot access for almost any party. You know, you could have three people in a phone booth and call it the Superman Party and you'd be on the ballot in California.
That's right.
But a lot of people who otherwise probably shouldn't be voting, and that includes celebrities as it came to be found out.
Demi Moore and a whole bunch of them,
thought they were independents, and so as soon as they saw American Independent Party, they just thought that those were monikers describing them, and they checked it off. And then they became registered voters or registered members of the American Independent Party, which was the Constitution Party's California
affiliate. Yeah.
And it just came out this year, earlier this year, as they were starting to investigate these, and some newspaper reporters started contacting these celebrities and told them, well, you know, this party's affiliated with this, this is what they believe. Oh, there was a lot of consternation over that because they didn't realize that they had registered for a party that probably they had nothing in common.
Well, it was inside baseball that basically the head of the party would drag around these proxies from all these registered voters and vote these proxies, people not realizing they'd signed proxies. And so this guy was voting all these proxies in party meetings, and they were fraudulently obtained.
Yeah, they were fraudulently.
Shall we say?
So they could control the process.
But that's that doesn't taint. Well, it does to an extent. Darryl Castle, only insofar as he was involved in some shenanigans with those big quote unquote big parties that couldn't. We once laughed that California had 335,000 members, and we laughed about that. And I go, how many of those 335,000 members did you get to vote for our presidential candidate? And the answer was about 8%. And so we would always go into the meetings and say, well, we got 17,000% of our 75 members to actually vote for our presidential candidate, which got us nowhere. Darryl is a fine guy. He was in too far with some of the bad people in the party, he's still a good guy.
Darryl was around when the Constitution Party was originally formed.
He was one of the original
the US
founders.
Taxpayers Party in 1992. He's one of the founding members of the party, and finally has acceded to taking on the very quixotic run for president of the Constitution Party.
Yeah. Yep. He's going to have a rough road to hoe on this, and unfortunately it's not going to go. I mean, their last presidential candidate was a former congressman by the name of Virgil Good. Unfortunately, I don't think Darryl has any real political experience.
I don't believe so, but again, that may actually be attractive to many now that Trump is flipping on so many issues, and who liked Trump because of the fact that he was not, supposedly not the establishment. They're looking for somebody, an outsider. And it's funny because the outsiders that they're picking are consummate insiders. On the Republican side, Donald Trump, who's been a big money magnet insider, using his money to influence politics to benefit his own personal business interests. And then Bernie Sanders, who's been a political insider by being in the United States Senate for the last 30-some years.
Oh, no, he started out as a House of Representatives.
Started out in the House, but then went over to the Senate. So, you know, two of the most consummate insiders that you could possibly have in either party is what all the quote-unquote disaffected folks who don't like the insider establishment milieu are running to. And
yeah.
But now they're starting to understand that the emperor has no clothes.
That's it. So,
you know, Trump is doing his thing. Bernie is, you know, I think the best thing Bernie can do is just stick it out through the convention and force the fight, because I believe what will happen is Hillary Clinton will come out of the nominating convention in July in Philadelphia looking at losing to a Donald Trump, unless they can create some more magic a la 1992 with Oscar Wright.
Yeah. Oh, well, we are out of time with that. And by the way, all this Daryl Castle could be a factor, but not much of one. So
I don't believe it's going to register on the radar.
No, but Gary Johnson and William Weld, yes, they could have a definite impact. Okay. That being said, we are out of time. Join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.